Added value tax came in at that
time. Added value tax came in, you're quite right indeed. 1968, 69, was it?
So these were all factors which...
I'll give you an interesting aside on added value. I'm wondering now a little bit. I'll give you an interesting aside on added value tax. VTA, as it was called in the French description of it. We had a turnover tax from the early 60s, 2.5%. But the concept of added value tax, a European concept, was a French concept. And the government here decided, look, we've got to go this way, but if we're going to Europe, we'll have to travel this way. You know, it's a problem of revenue. But I think I said to you earlier, at the time I was chairman of the Taxation Committee of the Confederation of Irish Industry. And that, where that had, I went out to Europe, I remember going to France, Denmark, Sweden, to study added value tax. I came back and I wrote a report. And I said that if the government imposed an added value tax of 10% on everything, including food, children's shoes, clothes, I was young and foolish, but I was also maybe radical in my thinking, it would produce enough revenue to allow the state to abolish income tax entirely.
I see, but it wasn't going to happen.
By the time it happened, state expenditure ballooned and the value of tax became 10%. But back to Jacobs.
Yes, yes.
The started building the plant, and Colin Brothers, they employed Colin, the big construction company, they employed a firm of managing agents. But difficulties arose, first, as with inflation costs, things started to go up in price. Secondly, the company, Jacobs that is, had no experience of managing a project, a physical, financial project of that size. And maybe this is a criticism, but maybe they were not good at bringing people in who had experience. They tended to depend on their own resources. They had a high regard for their own capacity to do things. And warranted, I have to say. But, you know, this was way outside the kind of experience and skill of most companies moving on this scale. A vast physical undertaking, not to mention moving 3,500 people, whatever they were. Anyway, they started into financial difficulties. They were to bill due every month. The main contractor to be paid £200,000 or £300,000 or something. It's a lot of money then.
And that's while the building was going on?
Yes.
And the manufacturing, of course, it was slowed still, down.
Well, the manufacturing was going on in Bishop Street.
Yes.
And it was early selling, like the month I joined, April 1971, the first biscuits were manufactured in Talla. Mallow biscuits were manufactured in Talla in April 1971 for the first time.
So could you tell me, you were brought into the company, were you brought in because of that move, because you, financially you could assist them in direction?
Yeah, as I said, I suppose I answered it out in the paper, but it really, there was a lot more to it than that. At the same time, the banks were pressurising the company. They were worried about their money. A very, very strange thing happened. In the early months of 1971, there was a bank strike.
That's right.
And the Irish banks had closed for 3 or 4 months. Now, at the same time, Jacobs had installed a new computer the previous year, and the computer got into difficulties. I have to say, in this area, it's quite extraordinary. Jacobs were always extraordinarily advanced in terms of information technology. Mm. They both in terms of the hardware of computers, the software, the management of computers. And one of the things that amazed me when I joined the company first was the amount of information they had about their business. One of the great strengths later in dealing with customers was we knew far more about the customer's business than the customer did.
Isn't that interesting?
I mean,
you know, the research and the work that went in behind.
We knew. I realised by about 1973, 74 that we probably were the only people in the country who knew the pecking order of grocery outlets up and down the country. Because, how do I say that? Because, say for instance, we knew exactly how many cream crackers sold in each grocery outlet. And that was a problem that was common right across the state. So if you knew the cream cracker sales in each outlet, you probably had a fair idea of the size of that outlet.
Yes.
And it was people like, I remember, like Don Tiley at Quinsworth, were the first people on the other side of the fence to relate to this. And I mean, information is gold, of course.
Of course it is.
You know, however, back to when I joined, yes, when the bank strike ended, it was found the company's bank overdraft had ballooned in the early months of 1971. And the banks then started to take an interest in... They were concerned about the management, I think, because a lot of people had been there, but there wasn't the kind of change you'd normally get in a large firm. You know, people come in, the people
go in. So are you saying they were getting stale, maybe?
Not so much that, but new skills were needed. You know, new approach, new skills. I came on the scene. Allied Irish Banks had just been formed a year or two previously. The Provincial Bank were Jacob's main bankers. And they were the Provincial, the Munster, Leinster, the Royal, became Allied Irish Banks. Now, I was very fortunate in that in my even first weeks at Jacob's, I joined as a financial controller. I found within a month the business was in serious trouble. I can remember my first meeting with the banks, going down to Lansdowne House, I think it was, the headquarters at the time. And just fortuitous, I'd come from Cork, that most of the people on the bank side of the table, it was only me and the Jacob side that evening for some reason or other, but most of the people on the other side of the table were Munster and Leinster bank people with Cork, strong Cork background, whom I knew. So
that was helpful.
It was very helpful indeed. We had a relationship. But yes, things were very difficult. I remember stages in 1971 worrying on a Thursday, would the wages check be met? But it became that difficult. The company had to approach the government of the day and indicate that it was in serious difficulties. And as a result, a consortium of banks, a very unusual thing then, I think seven banks, some of them American, I think one overseas bank, British bank, came together and put up £5 or £6 million, whatever it was. Huge money. And there were all kinds of conditions imposed on the company, obviously. So that's when I joined the board. I found myself working with people whose background would have been very different to my own, most of whom had spent a lifetime in the business. That was where they had started. Even the professional executives had started as trainees and management trainees. So they'd all grown up in the business. They all knew each other very well.
So, yes, you were breaking that mould.
Yes, yes, I was. And it's interesting the ways you break moulds. For instance, I remember one of my early meetings with my immediate colleagues, the management structure then was Gordon Lambert was the managing director. There were two assistant managing directors. I joined that group very quickly. And everybody addressed each other as Mr. Yeah. I'd come from a culture where people were Tom, Dick and Harry. So people were breaking moulds, Morris. Here, you know, calling somebody Gordon or Brian or Eric or whatever.
But they seem to accept you very quickly.
I was lucky. I was lucky, and you know, they were wonderful people. I have to say that. I hope in all the people you talked to in Jacob's, if you'd asked me one word to describe as a place to work, and I hope I'm not just saying this because of the position I occupied in the company, but I've worked in many places, both as an executive and in recent times much more as a non-executive. I would have described it as a very happy place to work in.
Yeah.
But yeah, I was fortunate in that I formed a good relationship, so particularly my older colleagues, and as I said, we came from different backgrounds, different cultures, different attitudes. Maybe attitudes not that different in some ways. We had a.
Did that change you?
Did it change me?
Yes.
It's very hard for me to say that. I think other people would say yes, probably yes.
You had no responsibilities that you never had before.
No, I never had before, no. No, that's quite right.
Oh, and yeah. And so to carry out those responsibilities, what did you do?
What did I do?
Yes. I mean, you dealt with the unions, for example.
Yeah.
How did you cope with them?
That was interesting because when I would deal with the unions, they would say things to me like, we were still kind of... I found that initially, I found it somewhat bewildering. I mean, this array of unions. First time I met all the unions collectively, I remember there were sitting on a huge table in Bishop Street. There were maybe 40, 50 people there. And as I said, I then worked out there were 19 different unions, and the personnel manager was with me. And I remember one man, he kind of kept harping away on some quite specific issue, an individual issue. And I said to him, you know, we're all here to represent somebody. I'm representing the company. You represent your union. And now, you know, you spent the last 10 minutes just talking about yourself. And I think we've got to be fair about this. Still remember his response. He said, I am the only member of my union working in this company. So after that, I was a lot more careful about what I said until I researched the facts.
Yeah.
The union thing was difficult. It was difficult for the company. It could be difficult for the employees too. And it was difficult, Morris, for the fact that we were entering into a period of great change.
Yeah.
For the company itself, as I just demonstrated, and for the workforce. Because huge changes were upcoming. We were concerned about the changes inside Jacobs, this move thing. I said earlier, 15, 20 years, one of my first decisions as I began to assume responsibility was to realise that this process could not last. It had to end within 5 years or we were dead. And even 5 years, I was an absolute outsider. That was 1972. And I went to London. In fact, I totally coincidentally, I had a meeting in a bank in London who were one of the consortium of bankers, a merchant bank called Brown Shipley. And they asked me to lunch. There was another man at the lunch, a number of clients. He was a property developer.
Yeah.
And we got talking. I explained I had this huge building in Dublin that eventually we were going to have to sell. And he said he was interested. And I explained, well, you know, one of those top-of-the-head things, really. Well, you couldn't have the occupation for 5 years. I need it for 5 years. That's okay. That's all right. Yeah, he had other projects in the pipeline. Long story short, he sent a man over. And then I said to the board of Jacobs, look, we can sell this place. We've got to be out in 5 years. In fact, the date was Good Friday, 1977. We have to be out. So I said, you know, that means I, the management, all of us, we're going to have to get the hell out of here in 5 years, out of town.
But that gave you a focus.
Oh, yes. That was the whole object of exercise, Morris. There was now a focus. There was no arguing. Trade union, management, Uncle Tom Copley and all, they could argue all the like. I should say, except the guy's taking the key on Good Friday, 1977, and we're gone. So we've got to get out of here. So we did. And we got our money and we went. But this was all going on. So obviously, if you were working inside the company, this was what your life was all about. Now, at the same time, if you were in a position I was in, you had to be mindful of what was going on outside. Yeah. And there were other things going on outside that would have major influence. Some of which I would say I and others could anticipate, did anticipate. Others, we didn't anticipate. Let me explain. Firstly, a very local matter, things called supermarkets were starting to develop. We had 12,000 customers. Not one of them. Not one of them was all that important. Maybe Musgrave's in Cork, the wholesalers. They were the biggest customer because they were closely related to Jacobs. They too were long, long time in business. But your Quinsworths, your Dunn stores, they didn't really matter very much. That was all to change in the years that followed. And changed quite quickly. By the end of the 70s, Dunn Stores, for instance, were a very big player. Quinsworth were a very big player. And these people were very aggressive. They were difficult to deal with. They all wanted price reductions. The thing they wanted above all else was, give me the product for half a penny less than he's getting it for.
I see.
You know, that's business. That's what it's all about. But that was to become a pressure point for all manufacturers, all food. To this day, you read about the pressures of... There were social changes at work. Ireland entered the EEC in 1973. And from that, a number of things flowed that were to be fundamental to Ireland and to Jacobs. And I mean fundamental. A relatively minor detail to start with. In around 1974, the concept of equal pay was introduced. And was phased in over time. But for a company that traditionally depended on a large female workforce, paid relatively low wages, this was a big, big issue. And I mean, the sums involved were staggering. But but at least it was phased in over time. Once competitors in Britain had the same problem. So I always used to say in business, as long as your competitor gets hit with the same storm, then you can cope, because you've all got to manage together. If something happens that hits you but not your competitor, the wind blows the roof off your factory but not off his, then you're in trouble.
Yeah.
And that happened. When Ireland entered, I'm going to say now has ramifications to the present day, not just for Jacobs, but to the Irish economy in total. When Ireland entered the EEC in 1973, the government said, yeah, we want to sign up to this. And in particular, we want to sign up to the Common Agricultural Policy. We want into this thing straight away. And the British said, no, wait a minute, no. We signed up, but this is Common Agricultural Policy thing. We want to take that very slowly, very carefully. What that meant is this. In Europe, pre-1973, pre our joining, there were very high prices for basic food commodities, like cereals, sugar beet, etc. Inflated, grossly inflated prices that bore no relationship to world prices for these commodities. And it's a way of subsidising farmers. This is the French, for the benefit of the French, this is the price the Germans had to pay to keep the French happy. Take sugar as an example. When we were paying something like £300 a tonne for beet sugar. I think cane sugar was selling at £20 a tonne and whatever. But the price shot up. The price of these basic foods in Europe was much higher than here. The Irish farm prices were phased in over 5 years, or whatever period it was. They were brought up to that level.
Yeah.
You may remember, people will remember, that through the 70s, the value of land in this country increased dramatically. Farming incomes increased dramatically. Mm-hmm. And the whole European gravy train started to roll. But there was a price to be paid. People who used agricultural products, like Jacobs, were paying dramatically more for their product.
Yes.
Now, that wouldn't have mattered. It would have mattered to some extent. It would have reduced consumption, obviously, if your product would become more expensive. But the real difficulty was, our British competitors were not paying the same price. Because the British government said, well, no, we're not having anything. We have a cheap food policy. And we're going to have a different regime. We'll go into the CAP eventually, but not now, thank you. So by 1976, we were paying 30% more for flour than our British competitors.
Well, that's a very interesting point, isn't it? I mean, it wasn't a level playing
pitch. It wasn't a level playing pitch, no. By 1976, 30% difference. Mm. And we lobbied the government here, I remember. Ian Plosgett wasn't part of the time. Telling, look, I mean, the way this thing is going, Jacobs will collapse. In fact, we lost money in 1977. Interesting statistic. I think I'm right in saying 150 years, the only time money year the company ever lost money. One year.
Yes, and but there was a whole lot of other things now.
There were other issues involved.
They were.
But this was fundamental, this cap, this difference in agricultural prices. And the government, in fact, took on board, Mark Clinton was the Minister for Agriculture at the time, went to Brussels. I spent a lot of time in Brussels myself then, one of my colleagues, Ben Power. And the government negotiated a deal whereby, it's an interesting thing, this was community-wide now, whereby when products like biscuits containing flour move from one market to another, a levy was imposed to equalise
the purchasing
of the flour, the sugar, yes. Whatever it happened to be. What do they call them? MCAs, yes. Monetary Compensatory Amounts. And we put enormous